What if you had one day to live? How would you use that day? What would you do? How would you spend it? The fact is that none of us know how many days we have to live. We only have one day. And how we spend our days adds up to how we spend our lives. Recently, we've seen a number of celebrity deaths popularized, well, maybe that's not the right word, celebrated on television, in the media. Ed McMahon, Farrah Fawcett, Carl Malden, Billy Mays, Steve McNair, and of course this last week, particularly Michael Jackson. Memorial services, tributes, eulogies have filled the television broadcasts. Michael Jackson's memorial service at the Staples Center in Los Angeles was attended by over 17,000 people, with millions watching around the world on television. It cost the city of Los Angeles $1.4 million just to provide security and traffic control. Funerals of the famous and the wealthy are often extravagant celebrations of life as people review all that they have done and all that they have filled their lives with. It was President Abraham Lincoln who, at the burial of one of his generals, said, "If he had known he'd get a funeral like this, he'd have died much sooner." Well, the common denominator in all funerals, whether famous or not, and I've done my share of funerals, the common denominator is that we remember the lives of those who have died. That's always part of any funeral or memorial service. In death, we review life. And King Saul, in 1 Samuel 31, knew he had one day to live. He had been told the night before that he would die in battle the next day. What would you do if you knew you would die tomorrow? The truth is that one day to live is too late to change the legacy of all of the days you already have lived. And ultimately, we are remembered for our lives, not just the last day of our lives. So I think as we come to the end of our study of 1 Samuel, that we ought to consider this matter of death and ask ourselves three questions as we look for those answers in the legacy of Saul in 1 Samuel 31. You know, if we take to heart the lessons we can learn from Saul and the legacy of his life, we can avoid the tragedy of Saul. The tragedy of a man who had but one day to change the legacy of his life. Here's the first question then. I think it's a question that we all ought to ask ourselves. And I know it's a beautiful Sunday morning, sunny out and all of that, and maybe death isn't the favorite topic on our minds, but it is worth asking these three questions as we think about each day that God gives us to live. And question number one is this: how will we be remembered? How will we be remembered? 1 Samuel 31, verse 1. Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel. The men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. And the battle went heavily against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and pierce me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and pierce me through and make sport of me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. So Saul took his sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword, and he died with him. Thus Saul died with his three sons, his armor-bearer, and all his men on that day together. So the sun rose that morning over Mount Gilboa. It was the day that Saul was doomed to die. He had been told this, yet he didn't run away. He was still there. The tragedy, though, is that not only would Saul die, but three of his four sons would die that day, and of course many other heroic soldiers would die in battle. The Philistine army on the other side of the Jezreel Valley at the base of the hill of Morah attacked that morning. The Israelites fought first in the valley, but of course the chariots of the Philistine army were overwhelming in the valley. They had a clear advantage. So the Israelites quickly retreated to the side of Mount Gilboa where their base camp was located. This picture looks west in the Herod Valley, which actually opens into the valley of Jezreel, which is a wide open plain right about the base of the hill of Morah. It opens up into the valley of Jezreel, and this side is the Herod Valley. The Philistine army is attacking from the hill of Morah. The Israelites are on the slopes of Mount Gilboa. And we are looking in this picture from a city known as Beit Shean. Beit Shean was located at the other end of the Herod Valley, looking west. Beit Shean, you need to know, was a Philistine city. So as the Philistines attacked from the hill of Morah with the Israelite army on Mount Gilboa, Beit Shean, the Philistine city, on the other end of the valley, you can see that the Israelite army is caught between the onrushing Philistine army and the Philistine city of Beit Shean. There was no place to hide, and the slaughter took place. Somewhere on the slopes of Mount Gilboa, the Philistines overtook and killed the three sons of Saul, including Jonathan. We assume that Jonathan, knowing Jonathan, that he put up a heroic battle, but died that day. I just want to stop. I love Jonathan. I love the story of Jonathan. This man is an incredible man of God. He is a man who served his father with loyalty, even though his father had destroyed the family, the kingdom, and had turned his best friend away from him. He still served his father with integrity right to the very end, with loyalty. Jonathan was a man of integrity. He had dreamed of the day when he would stand with his friend David when David became king. He was ready to take second place to God's plan for the nation, second place to David. And he dreamed, in fact, he told David this earlier when we studied it, you remember, that he told David, "I will gladly stand second with you when God makes you king." Even though he was the heir apparent to the throne, he was ready to sacrifice. Jonathan, the loyal friend, would give up his kingdom for God's plan for David to rule. But it was not to be. Jonathan would die for his father's sins that day. That's the tragedy of sin. Sin and its consequences affect those we love. Saul, with his armor-bearer, knew the end was near. He asked the armor-bearer to kill him. The man refused. Saul then committed suicide, followed by his loyal armor-bearer. So the slopes of Gilboa were littered with the dead and dying that evening. It was a horrible defeat for the nation of Israel, all because of the disobedience of their king, King Saul. So as we look at Saul's death, we can't help but look back at his life and see the seeds of tragedy that were sown years earlier. Saul was a man of immense talent, good looking. Everybody liked him. He was the epitome of what people thought their king should be. Talented, given great opportunities by God, given the blessings of God, chosen by God, given God's help. He is the man who had it all to start with, including God's blessing, but he disobeyed God. He turned instead to his own pride, his own ego, and his own plans, and God rejected him as king. And Saul, consumed with his own pride, fell into this brooding despair, this sinful despondency. And slowly, pride and jealousy ate his life away from the inside out until we come to the end of his life and we remember Saul as a failure, a flawed and broken and failed man. Imagine a funeral. The preacher is giving the eulogy, and suddenly the guest of honor pops up out of the coffin. That actually happened. Talai George Sogwe of South Africa decided to fake his own death as a test. "I wanted to know what people would say about me when I'm dead," he said. "I'm satisfied they spoke the truth about me and not lies." George says he's going to keep the coffin for his real funeral, which may be held sooner than he thinks if he keeps pulling stunts like that. Have you ever wondered what people would say about you when you were dead at your funeral? We all want to know how we'll be remembered. We may not think about it a great deal, but we do want to know. What will be the defining stories of your life? It's worth thinking about when your family gathers to remember you. I don't mean to be melodramatic this morning, but the way we live out our days now becomes the life we will be remembered by at death. That's just the way it is. It's useful to consider how we are living now by asking how we will be remembered then. James Dobson tells this story about a man at his father's funeral who described at that funeral to James Dobson one of the most painful experiences of his life. When he was 17 years old, he was one of the stars on his high school football team. But his father, a very successful man and a leading businessman in the city, was always too busy to come see him play. The final game of the season came around, which happened to have been the state championship for that year. The boy was desperate to have his dad there to watch him play in the state championship game his senior year. The night of the big game, he was on the field warming up when he looked into the stadium just in time to see his father arrive with two other men, all three of them dressed in business suits. They stood talking together for a moment or two, and he was excited. But then all three of them left. The man told Dobson that story when he was 58 years of age. And Dobson said he had tears streaming down his cheeks as he relived the moment so long ago. It had been 40 years since that night. 40 years. And yet the rejection and the pain were still vivid in his memory. And as he stood with James Dobson that day by his dad's body in the mortuary, he said, "Dad, I never really knew you. We could have shared so much love together, but you never had time for me." That was his legacy. "You never had time for me." What's the legacy you are leaving? What is mine? How will we be remembered on that day? That is the first question of death. The second question: who will dishonor us? Who will dishonor us? Put another way, who will be happy at our death? Who will celebrate when we die? Now, that seems like a rather odd question to ask. Who's going to be happy when I die? odd way to evaluate our lives, but not a bad way. In fact, of course, we are often told not to speak badly of the dead at funerals. You're supposed to only say good things at funerals. The pastor at Steve McNair's funeral issued that warning by saying that everyone should not judge his life by his death. That was his warning to the congregation this past week. The laws of etiquette proclaim that we should not speak ill of the dead, especially those who have recently passed away. There's one place, however, where this offense is being committed with regularity, and that's online obituary guest books. You know, that's the new thing, right? The online obituary guest books. Legacy.com is a company that provides online obituary services for more than 300 newspapers in the United States, processes more than 18,000 notes every day. But not all of these messages are glowing tributes. In fact, the company assigns 45 of its 75 employees and spends 30% of its budget to intercept messages they call dissing the dead. Some of the barbs are unmistakable, such as off-color insults, scathing accusations. Many others are subtle, such as this one. Here's one. Reading the obituary, it sounds like he was a great father. This was signed, His Son, Peter. Kenneth Doka, professor of gerontology, believes computer technology has made it easier for people to say something with one click rather than write a letter and put it in a mailbox. In more than 25 years of grief counseling, Doka says, I can cite only a couple of instances of people communicating mean things to the family of someone who died by sending them a letter or writing in the paper guest book that's there in the funeral home. On the other hand, I have talked to a lot of funeral directors who have put online guest books, and they say the level of screening required is a real problem because people are putting negative things on the online obituary guest books. Well, the reality is that every funeral has its negative side. There's nobody's perfect. And there are always things that we have done or said, regrets that are there. We just rarely bring it out in the open. And often, as I do funerals, there are people sitting there who have negative feelings and opinions about the person who has died and about the life that was lived. So I come back to my question. Who will dishonor us at our death? Maybe that's improper etiquette, yet in an odd way, it can tell us much about who we are and how we are living today. Now, Saul has done many things wrong in his life. We know that. We have studied that. He has been a failure in many ways. But he has done some things right. And even on the day he dies, he is doing something right. The Philistines are the ones who will dishonor Saul and celebrate his death. Why? Because he has been their enemy throughout life. Verse 7, we pick up here. And when the men of Israel, who were on the other side of the valley with those who were beyond the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled. Then the Philistines came and lived in them. And it came about on the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his weapons and sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news. By the way, this is gospel, to carry the gospel. The gospel of the Philistines, anyway, to carry the good news to the house of their idols. See, the gospel of the Philistines was the good news of their idols. And to the people. And they put his weapons in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beit Shean. Everyone makes enemies in life. Think about it this way. If our enemies are God's enemies, then whose side are we on in the battle? God's. We're on God's side in the battle. The Philistines were God's enemies, and Saul had fought against them his whole life. He was fighting against them even though he had been told he would die the next day. He didn't run away. He stayed and fought. That means that Saul has fought on God's side his entire career. And the Philistines proved this by what they did with Saul's body. They cut off his head, they stripped his weapons, they sent these symbols throughout the land of the Philistines in a celebration. They present these tokens, this good news, to their idols, to Ashtoreth, the Philistine goddess. They presented these victory symbols. In other words, the Philistines saw this victory over Saul and the death of Saul as a victory of their gods over Saul's God. Saul was a symbol of Saul's God to them because he had fought for God faithfully against the Philistines. So if you look at this as a spiritual battle, you realize that Saul has been working and fighting on God's side all these years. In fact, when God called Saul to be king, he specifically commissioned him through the prophet Samuel in 1 Samuel 9 to deliver God's people from the Philistines. Your job, Saul, is to fight the Philistines and to deliver the people from the Philistines. Well, Saul may have failed to deliver the people from the Philistines because of his disobedience, but he did fight the Philistines as God had called him to do. His failure was a failure of disobedience, or better yet, his failure was a failure of halfway obedience, wasn't it? Half-hearted obedience. It wasn't that he just set out and said, "I'm not doing your way, God." He only did it halfway. It was a halfway obedience. Saul was a master at obeying halfway. Yet we should also remember Saul for who dishonored him. The Philistines fastened his body to the wall of the city of Beit Shean to insult not just Saul, but Saul's God. In a war, you are either on one side or the other. In God's holy war, you are either on God's side or the side of God's enemies. Saul served on God's side, and his enemies celebrated his death because they were celebrating their victory over God. Who dishonors us tells us who honors us. It tells us who we serve. Who gets angry with us tells us much about whether we have our priorities straight or not. It was a 99-degree September day in San Antonio, Texas, when a 10-month-old baby girl was accidentally locked inside a parked car by her aunt. Almost 100 degrees outside. Frantically, the mother and the aunt ran around the auto in near hysteria while a neighbor attempted to unlock the car with a clothes hanger. Soon they could see the infant was turning colors, had foam on her mouth. It had become a matter of life and death when Fred Areola, a wrecker driver, pulled up on the scene. He looked at it, he grabbed a hammer, he smashed the back window of the car in, and he set the baby free. He saved the baby's life, and the baby was okay. What do you think their response was? Fred said, "The lady was mad at me because I broke the window. I just thought, what's more important, the baby or the window?" Here's this wrecker driver, he says he's going to get sued because he broke the lady's window, but he saved the baby's life. Now, which is more important? You know what? It's an honor to have someone angry with you for breaking a window if by breaking that window you saved a baby's life. Right? The dishonor honors right priorities. When I die, I don't know when that is. I hope it's a while longer, but we'll see. When I die, I hope that I am dishonored by those who hate God. Because if I am dishonored by those who hate God, then I am honored for having served God. The dishonor of those who hate God is an honor for those who serve God. So we should ask ourselves first, how will we be remembered? Second, who will dishonor us? And third, why will we be honored? Why will we be honored? Verse 11. Now when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men rose and walked all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan, and they came to Jabesh, and they burned them there. And they took their bones, and they buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and fasted 7 days. So across the Jordan River Valley from Bethshan was the village of Jabesh in the territory of Gilead. The men of Jabesh-Gilead were close enough to know what had happened to the Israelite army, how the Philistines had desecrated the bodies of Saul and his sons. We learn that not only did the Philistines fasten Saul's body to the walls of Bethshan, but they did the same with the bodies of his three sons. So all four of them are there. It was a terrible insult, obviously, for the Israelites. Not giving the body a proper burial was offensive. So the men of Jabesh courageously decided to do something about it. They traveled all night. They covered approximately the 12 miles between the two cities. They covertly and carefully stole the bodies from the wall of the Philistine city. They returned the 12 miles to Jabesh. Now, this was a very risky undertaking. To be able to sneak up on an armed city and take the bodies off the wall of the city meant covertly finding a way through armed soldiers and the homes that surrounded the city. Ancient cities, by the way, the people lived around the city wall on the outside, and then the citadel, the city itself with its large wall, would have been in the middle where they would run to if they needed safety. So they had to make their way through village and through soldiers and all of that in order to get to the wall, take the bodies down from the wall, and get back out of there. That was no easy task. They risked their lives to give Saul and his sons a proper burial. They're already dead, but they're going to risk their lives to give them an honorable and proper burial. Why? Well, the reason takes us all the way back to the beginning of Saul's story in 1 Samuel chapter 11. In 1 Samuel chapter 11, the Ammonites had laid siege to the city of Jabesh-Gilead, and they were about to be slaughtered. So they sued for peace, and the Ammonites told them, "We will let you go free, but every man in your village, every warrior, must come out and have his eye gouged out. And then you will serve us for your entire lives." They asked for 1 day, and they sent messengers. And you know who answered? King Saul. It's one of the greatest moments of his life. He didn't have a lot of them, but this was a great moment in his life. King Saul rallied the troops. He had just become king. He rallied the troops, and they came, and they fought the Ammonites. They defeated the Ammonites. They saved the men of Jabesh-Gilead. They defeated Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, who's also known as the snake. They saved the men of Jabesh-Gilead. They risked their lives for the men of Jabesh-Gilead. And those men never forgot that. It was one of the high points of Saul's life. And now they will risk their life to give Saul the honor he deserves for that moment in his life, because he risked his life for them years earlier. So they stole the bodies. They brought them back to Jabesh. They burned the bodies to destroy all the contamination. And they buried their bones with honor and dignity. And they fasted for 7 days to honor Saul and his life and his service. Someone has said that everyone deserves to be honored for the best they have done in life. I like to remember that as I do funerals. There is truth in that saying. We are flawed people, but there is good that is done that ought to be honored, like Saul. Saul may have failed miserably many times in his life. He died a miserable man, guilt-ridden, but he had done some good in his life, and he's honored here for the good he did. Patrick Morley, in his book, which I recommend, it's a bit dated now, but I recommend to men. Patrick Morley is a businessman who wrote a book called The Man in the Mirror, Solving the 24 Problems Men Face. And he tells about the time that he and his wife, going through some difficulties in their lives, trying to sort through the calendar and all of the events and all of the responsibilities and the things that they had to do in life, the time-consuming demands, and they were having a hard time sorting through and prioritizing. And the thought came to them that they should prioritize everything they did based on who's going to be crying at their funeral. He said, that is a remarkable way of bringing it down to the people God has put in your life. And prioritizing. Who's going to be crying at my funeral? That question focuses us on the priorities God has placed in our lives instead of wasting our time pursuing everything else that will lead us nowhere in the end. As has been said, no one at the end of their lives wishes they'd spent more time in the office. I've stood with a lot of people nearing their death. I have yet to hear somebody wish they had spent more time working. The regrets that people share, if they have regrets, they're all about failing those who will be crying at their funerals, failing those that God had put in their lives and whom they were responsible for, or the lives they could have touched with the time that God gave them. Not about failing to make more money in the business world. I've never yet heard anyone think that. It was Colonel Sanders of Kentucky Fried Chicken who famously said, there's no reason to be the richest man in the cemetery. He's right. Nancy Hauser told Sports Illustrated these words after her husband resigned as manager of the Kansas City Royals a few years back. Dick Hauser had two surgeries for brain cancer, which led to his resignation from the baseball organization, the Kansas City Royals. Nancy said this to Sports Illustrated. As a child, I was brought up to believe that it was not whether you won or lost, but how you played the game. Then in the real world, I found that to be all wrong. There I learned you have to win to get anywhere. And it didn't matter how you did it. But now, after what has happened to my husband Dick, I realize that my priorities in the so-called real world were all wrong. Now Dick and I know that the old way was the right way. You know, it really and truly is how you play the game. The time to evaluate the legacy we are building is now, not later. It is how we play the game. How am I using each day of the life God gives me? Am I investing it in people who will honor that investment in their lives after I am gone? Am I investing it in people and activities that last, that have eternal value? Or am I chasing dreams that have no lasting value? How I invest this day is how I invest my life. God brings into our lives people and experiences for us to invest in. And yet so many spend so much time racing off on this dream and that wish and this goal and that desire and never invest eternally in the people that God has in your life. What will be my legacy to those who know me best? Some cities are famous for their landmarks. Paris for the Eiffel Tower, Rome for the Colosseum, San Francisco for the Golden Gate Bridge. So, well, there's tiny Darwin, Minnesota, and its unusual claim to fame. A giant ball of twine. It weighs 7,400 pounds. 7,400 pounds. It is 12 feet in diameter, 40 feet around, and was the creation of Francis Johnson, pictured here. He started wrapping it in March of 1950, 4 hours a day, every day. Francis lifted it with a crane to continue proper wrapping. He spent 29 years winding twine into a ball that, like the legend of the Energizer Bunny, just kept growing and growing and... never mind. Johnson, a bachelor farmer who had obviously a lot of time and twine on his hands, started his project in 1950. He didn't quit till 1979, when he was 74 years old. He just couldn't handle it anymore, says his nephew, Harling Johnson. For 24 years, he was listed in the Guinness Book of Records as the biggest string ball in the world, until somebody decided to do one bigger. Johnson didn't stop there. He also had a collection of 7,000 wood pencils, 1,700 carpenter's aprons, and a total of 20,000 old irons, toy sewing machines, ancient tools, and other things. He died in 1989, but his legacy lives on. His twine ball now sits tall and proud in downtown Darwin, which recently built a cafe in its honor, the Twine Ball Inn. The town also holds an annual celebration called Twine Ball Days. Wow. Honored, remembered for rolling string into a ball. I truly hope that my legacy has more meaning than a rolled up ball of string. Don't you? Again, I think of Pat Morley in his book, The Man in the Mirror. He gives us a good way to test the significance of life. He calls it the game of tens. And here are some adapted questions from his game of tens, updated perhaps a little bit. First, test yourself with these questions. Can you name the 10 wealthiest men in the world? Can you name the 10 top corporate executives in America? Can you name the last 10 Super Bowl champions? Or you could do Emmys or whatever you wanted, okay? Can you name the last 10 Nobel Prize winners? Can you name 10 members of President Obama's cabinet or President Bush's cabinet? You see, when we play the game of tens, we quickly realize that fame and fortune are fleeting at best. Who can remember these kinds of people, even though they might be front page news? One executive said to several other men as he retired after his retirement, he told them, "My advice to you is enjoy it now," because he said, "After you're retired, when I was an executive, I picked up the phone, I could call almost anybody and they would answer me. After I was retired, nobody would return my phone calls." It happens just like that. That's how fleeting all of this is. And the game of tens is ruthless in sorting out priorities. Try playing it this way. Name 10 people who will attend your funeral. Name 10 family members who love you. Name your 10 best friends. Name the 10 most memorable experiences of your life. Name 10 accomplishments that will outlast your death. One day to live. How will we use it? Father, we don't want to end up in the tragedy that Saul became. We want to live for you. Help us to understand that each day is your gift to us. And the people in our lives are our first ministries. Help us to invest in the priorities that you place on our lives and in the people and the activities that have eternal value. In Jesus' name, amen.